Lane Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh, look at this. It's a sunny morning. We got a show ahead of us, and it's going to be fun. I've been thinking about tools. All week I've been thinking about tools. It's a big obsession of mine, having really neat tools, the right tools for the job. And I've been writing and thinking about lately how we use tools to eliminate us. You know, we've talked a little bit about that. It's crazy. Somebody says, I'm going to get one of those little what radar kind of whatever, what do you call them, like robots that mow your lawn for you, or and we're going to get eliminated from the scene. I don't like tools that eliminate people, and there's a lot of reasons I don't like tools that eliminate people. I think I've told you why. I mean, the first one is that people are really kind of, if they put their minds to it, if they put their bodies to it, they do things that most machines can't do. They just can't do them. The really productive things, the really useful things that people do, machines can't imitate that. And I know there's all kind of nonsense out there about AI, but that's mostly about tasks that really don't matter that much. Honestly. So what if a computer beats you at chess? It doesn't matter. That's a kind of a mathematical game. And that's okay. It teases you. It's good. I like chess. It's fun. But that's not about what humans do well. We got these great bodies. You know, I don't know if you've noticed that you have a body. And it's a really useful thing. It's got these two arms and these two legs and all that stuff in between. It's got fingers, opposable thumbs. You can really put it to good use, and you got this mind, you got the senses, you got your eyes, which are far more effective than any camera we've got now. You got your ears, you got your sense of smell. All those things get used, and the good tools are the tools that use you, and all you are, your good sense, your good senses. And I think about that a lot. I was talking to somebody this week about how to clear some land and what kind of tools to use and what are the best tools to use. And, you know, is it a motorized tool? Is it a tractor? Well, there's a lot of ways of thinking about it. A lot of variations in between. Whichever tool you use should use you well. Should use your abilities well. I've been out using that tool that we all have to use a lot right now. It's the lawnmower. Oh, Lord have mercy. Have we not built our lives around the lawnmower? It's hilarious. It is hilarious because we decided that our landscapes had to look like landscapes up north where they don't have to mow the lawn very much because it's so dadgum cold all the time. They have a short growing season. So we've built our lives around mowers, and we've made, now we're building our landscape around the mowers as well. Let me tell you, I'll just tell you my thoughts about mowers, because we almost had a little argument in my household the other day, because the argument was, well, we could get one of them riding lawnmowers. We could get a riding lawnmower and ride all around the yard. And I thought, God, it'd be so much more fun on a horse. I don't want to ride around. But that's nonetheless, let me tell you about riding lawnmowers. And one of the funny things is, it's really hard to design a big riding lawnmower that will cut your yard well. I don't want to get into a lot of arguments. It ain't worth it. Because ultimately, a yard doesn't matter that much. It shouldn't matter that much. We're not trying to put it, you know, it's not like we're trying to put the finishing touches on some fine piece of furniture. It's just a yard. But the big mowers make it harder. And a small mower, the one that you push, is just a great mower. And I often think that if you want to understand tools, and if you want to use your body well, and if you want to make your yard better and more enjoyable, use a push lawnmower. I don't think the ones that I think you probably need a mower in our climate. I think it's very hard. We don't have one designed for our grasses and in our climate that don't have a mower, that don't have a motor attached. But a little electric lawnmower is great. Electric lawnmower is wonderful. The lighter it is, the better it is. It's really easy to manage. You just kind of, it's really simple. You don't have to manage putting gas in it. You don't have to worry about all that crazy stuff. It's great. But if you get a big lawnmower, you're going to mow too much. It's just inevitable. That's the first thing. And you're going to look for places to mow to justify having that big, big riding lawnmower. That's the thing I object to maybe most about the big riding lawnmower. The little push lawnmower, you really shouldn't be mowing any more than you could push. Now, you might argue that it's easier for you to have to sit on that lawnmower and watch your belly jiggle as the mower turns, and it's going to jiggle because in large measure you're sitting on that lawnmower rather than pushing it, and all that's fine. It's a way of appreciating your body, pushing the lawnmower, appreciating what it does well, what it needs to do. That's all fine, but you know, using the right tool. Let me tell you what I did with my lawnmower this week. So if I'm going to use a lawnmower, dadgummit, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to enjoy it. So I don't feel like I got to mow everything, every day, every time I mow. That's one way to enjoy your lawn. Don't feel like you got to mow everything. Make patterns in the lawn. Is that crazy? No, it's not crazy. It's just sensible. It's smart. It's thinking about what lawns are for. If you think about, I'm not going to mow my whole yard this week. I'm just going to make some patterns in it. It helps to remind you what lawns are really good at, which is to sort of provide a pathway from one part of your yard to another. That's a great thing. And it'll help you to understand what those pathways are. So mow your pathways. Think about where your pathways are as you mow. Just mow those pathways for a while. Next week, you can come back and mow everything else if you like. Just mow those pathways. It's fine. Don't mow it too close. We can talk about all that. But just have fun. Mow a little design. Mow a little circle. So here's what I did. I've got Rumex. Let me think of what you call it. It's wild sorrel. It's coming up. It's coming up in portions of this area that we have. Not quite a pasture. It's not that big. It's not quite a yard either. It's just an area that I have to get through to get from one part of my garden to the other. And there's Rumex coming up. There's sorrel. There's wild sorrel. And it's got these beautiful red seed heads. I mean, they are just beautiful rusty red. And that's nice in and of itself. And they're sitting about, they're maybe shin height. Think how beautiful that is, and I want to preserve them because I know that when the birds come, when the quail come, when the dove come, they are going to love those seeds of that sorrel. Sorrel is one of the best quail foods you can get, by the way, for all you hunters, or for people who just love quail. Dove, quail, all sorts of birds are going to be all over that sorrel. They are going to love it. They're going to think, God, what a nice guy he is. And I get to listen to him. I get to hear my old Bob Whites. Isn't that nice? So I'm just leaving a little island with the sorrel. And then over here, the clover was coming up. Now, I don't know what uses clover exactly, but it's pretty enough. The bees use it. The European bees use it, for sure. And that's okay, and it's pretty, though. It just was pretty. So I left a little island. There's a nice little island right there, and it's just like, and my wife came out and said, isn't that interesting? Isn't that beautiful how that clover grows in just that little pattern? Wasn't that fun? It's interesting, and people are going to look at that and say, boy, that's interesting.
That's pretty.
Is that crazy? You know, it teaches you what a mower's for. It's to have fun. Don't mow your whole yard. Don't feel like you got to. Oh, you're going to fire me, aren't you? But it's good for you. Using tools the right way. Hey, we're going to be back. We're going to talk a little bit more about tools. We're going to talk about your garden. We're going to talk about all the stuff going on. Feel free to give us a call. 251-343-0106.
Sun will go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian. Just across the line in a little southeast.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Oh, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast. Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a good Sunday morning. Looking forward to this day. Looking, going to get some work in between rainfall. If we get a little, I think we probably will this week. But I think I'll be able to get some work done. Like the temperatures. They're really nice. It's going to stay cool for a while. That's really good, too. That's really useful. Somebody sent me a picture of a beautiful satsuki. It is absolutely breathtaking. I mean, I want to say that is just everything. It is unbelievably beautiful. I wish that we had the opportunity in Mobile to explore these satsukis better. We've kind of lost track of where we are. We've lost track of the satsukis in some pretty sad ways, and the other azaleas that made Mobile famous. Boy, we could have been a great azalea city. But, you know, these azaleas are still out there. The beautiful satsukis. Martin Vandergeesen's producing most of them. I mean, he's really the centerpiece of it. The Mobile Botanical Gardens can, if they like, decide to use some of Martin's plants at the sales, and I hope they continue to purchase them. But gosh, I don't know the name of it. I'll have to be honest. But that is just one of the really beautiful, beautiful satsukis. I'm sure that came from Martin. He had the best and still does. That is just absolutely stunningly beautiful. If you want to see the satsukis blooming, you can go out to Mobile Botanical Gardens. I think they probably still probably in pretty good shape, and check them out. They started blooming in late March and early April, but they'll continue blooming into May, many varieties, and just what a beautiful thing. And then they'll rebloom in fall. A lot of those, not all of them, but a lot of the satsukis, and there are many different kinds. They tend to be much smaller, the satsuki azaleas, than the big evergreen azaleas that we normally use, the big southern Indians, which get to be 8 feet tall. Satsukis, many of the varieties, are rarely over waist high. Many you can really keep to about 3 feet forever. Very, very easy, very beautiful little things, wonderful things. But just the flowers, it's hard to describe how beautiful the flowers are. And many varieties, like the one I'm looking at, excuse me for going home, but this thing is beautiful. Each flower is a little different, isn't it? It'll be white with a little red stripes on it, beautiful red color. Some of them will have speckles and stripes. Some of them will be nearly solid. Some of them will be nearly pure white. And look at this one. These are red with this white center. And that's the variability that was built into these satsukis by the Japanese breeders over hundreds of years. Maybe, I don't know, hundreds of years. I think of them as the azaleas of the samurai, of the great families of Japan, who used many of these azaleas as emblems of their families. Because they were so beautiful, and it showed how cultivated their families were to appreciate beauty like these azaleas. They're incredibly beautiful, incredibly stunning, really, really beautiful things. You know, so the question about, I'm gonna try to do this real quickly, because the question came up last week about soil tests. And I said, you know, soil tests don't tell you really what you need to know mostly about your yard. They really don't work. They're really for depleted soils. They only tell you how depleted it is. And they really don't tell you, a lot. So how do you do what a soil test does? First off, if one of the important things to know is that a soil test is supposedly tells you how acid or alkaline your soil is, and some do that okay. The soil test kits don't do it very well at all, the little kits you buy. Acidity and alkalinity are it's a measure, it's a scale. On one end is acidity, down something really, really acid is going to be between 2 and 3. And I mean, that's really acid. That's going to be like burn your skin acid. And alkalinity is going to be up around on the scale, something really alkaline, like lye, that could really just burn your skin, is going to be around, it's going to be 10 or above. In the middle is, about 7. And that's not too acid or too alkaline. Now, all this sounds very clever and very smart, and it sounds like this is how gardens work. And to some degree it is, because it's a measure of hydrogen ions in the soil, which is a measure of how many reactions, how many good chemical reactions can occur in that soil. And all that's very fine. But here's the interesting part, and this is why soil tests are very deceptive. Because in most yards, the issue isn't what is your absolute acidity or alkalinity. The problem is how much organic matter is in your soil. Because organic matter is as potent, if not more potent in many cases, than acidity and alkalinity in determining what kind of good soil reactions occur. And what kind of life is in your soil. And that organic matter is also important for another really good reason, and that is that it tells you how much oxygen is available in your soil. And if you don't think oxygen is important, you've missed it. Oxygen is way more important than nitrogen. It's way more important than potassium. It's way more important than phosphorus. It's way more important than alkalinity or acidity. Because if you don't have oxygen in your soil, your roots aren't going to survive. And oxygen doesn't get into your soil very easily. And particularly when your soil gets compacted, it doesn't get in there. And the other thing that soil tests don't do very well, conventional soil tests, is they don't tell you how much water can your soil hold. And that's a function of how much oxygen can it hold. They sort of work together. And if you don't have water and oxygen in your soil in sufficient quality and in the right balance, you ain't going to be able to grow anything. I don't care what the pH is. And the organic matter itself governs how much oxygen and water is available in most soils. And not only that, but it also lessens the need to worry about the acidity or the alkalinity of the soil. Where do you look on your soil test to find the organic matter? Well, for most soil tests, you don't. It ain't on there. It doesn't tell you anything about it. So it doesn't help. There are very expensive soil tests that Auburn's developing that are a much better measure. And I think that they're available now. I haven't availed myself of one recently, and I haven't been able to get in touch with Auburn to find out exactly how it's working recently. I did send some messages, but didn't get any replies. But I do think that, and I'll try to track that down a little better. I'll nail somebody. I'll knock on somebody's door till they answer. And we'll get a little bit of an answer about how those new soil tests work. But let me tell you how you can look at your yard and tell. You look at the history of the yard. If you haven't been liming and you haven't been adding and you haven't been letting grass clippings or tree mulch fall into your yard on a regular basis, I can guarantee you, if you haven't done those things, if you haven't limed, if you don't have lots of tree leaves or grass leaves falling into the yard, I can guarantee you that your yard is pretty acid. That's what happens here because of high rainfall. It happens throughout the state of Alabama. There are a couple of exceptions. I'll talk about them. But you can just about bet your soil is pretty acid. Probably going to be, naturally, it's going to drop down to around 5. In some sandy places where there's no organic matter left, it may be between 4 and 5. That can be very difficult, a pH of 4 and 5. And honestly, at that level, without, because it says there's no organic matter in that soil, basically, at that level, it's going to be really hard to grow anything. Even blueberries are going to struggle down at a pH between 4 and 5. And just a little bit, just raising your pH from 5 to 5.5 makes a big difference. And 5.5 to 6 makes a huge difference. So we'll come back here in just a minute and talk a little bit more about that.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, yeah. I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country.
We should talk about peaches, I reckon, and I'll do that, and plums and some other things, but somehow I feel like we ought to finish this conversation about soil tests and how you can judge your yard without using a soil test. And as I said, the key here is organic matter. It's thinking about soil tests, conventional soil tests. If you've got too much organic matter, if your soil is healthy, in short, it messes the soil test up. It's incredible, isn't it? Healthy soil messes the soil test up. It can't deal with high organic content. It doesn't know what to do with it. Because most soils are depleted soils. They're not healthy soils. And so it just kind of tells you how unhealthy your soil is, assuming you're going to do nothing except add chemicals. But the chemicals aren't going to fix the big problems in your yard. As I said, it's the organic matter, it's the oxygen, it's the water availability, the oxygen availability that's most important. If you get those things right, everything else is going to be right. So soil tests don't do that. But so how are you going to look at your yard? I said that most yards are going to be acid because rainfall, high rainfall environments are going to leach out most of the hydrogen ions. And so you're not going to, that's just going to make it more acid. Okay. And that acid soil is, when it gets too low, when it gets below about 5, pH of about 5, it gets really hard for a lot of plants to grow. A lot of plants prefer to grow around 6 and 6.5. That may not sound like a lot of difference, but it is a big difference. Now, do you want to get your chemical lab out and measure exactly what the pH is at each of those levels? I have never done that. Because it's really not necessary, because the organic matter does that for you. Let the organic matter and the creatures that it embeds in the soil and encourages in the soil, let that be your chemist. You don't need to be a chemist. You don't need those fine little adjustments in pH. You don't even need to measure them, because the organic matter is going to do it for you. Now, we've talked about getting a real good soil test from Auburn, and I'm going to look at that. But let's just look at this real quickly. Almost every soil in Alabama is going to be acid, except in a few places. And I'll tell you where they are. Let's start at the coast first. If you live within a in an area around a salt marsh or where there's lots of salt spray, there's a chance your pH may be kind of high. And that's because of the contact with the ocean and because of the salts associated with the ocean and other things going on there. It's going to be really hard for you to grow things in that environment. But your pH may be a little bit higher. And that's a pretty narrow zone. Pretty narrow zone. It's a, really the intertidal zone and a little higher. If you live where there are shell mounds, oh, I hope you don't. But if you do happen to live where there are shell mounds and you're growing your garden on it or your grass on it, oh, that would be so sad. But if you did, and there were natural shell mounds or shell hash, your pH is going to be a little bit high. But that's really rare. Most of you don't do that. You can call me and ask me. You can send me pictures that we can talk about that. If you use shell for your driveway, the pH on that drive is going to be pretty high. If you live around St. Stephen's, or if you live up around Grove Hill, and you live near some limestone prairies, or if you live in the siltstone areas of the Red Hills, you may have a higher pH, and you'll have to think about that. If you live in the Black Belt of Alabama, the real Black Belt, the original Black Belt, the prairie Black Belt, and you've got gray soils or soils that tend to grow grasses or that have a large shrink swell, the soils crack really easily, you're going to have a higher, you probably have a higher pH, and you'll have to think about that. But those are the exceptions. And I want to stress that most of you don't live in those places. Most of you don't have soils like that. If you do, if you think you do, you can call me. We can talk about that specifically. But the fact of the matter is, you need the organic matter. If you can add the organic matter to your soil, you can add a little bit of lime if you haven't added it before. And just, you know, it doesn't have to be extremely precise, but you probably will need to add lime if you've just started adding organic matter. Over time, that lime becomes less important for most crops and probably not good for most crops. And the cool thing is, if you do that, if you add the organic matter, if you start by adding the organic matter, you're going to raise the pH in almost every soil. You'll stabilize it at the right level. It's going to come out where plants like it at about 6 or 6.5. That's right. That's what leaves from trees, they break down into about 6 or 6.5 pH, even pine needles. So it's going to be in the zone that plants need. The organic matter does the chemistry for you. I hope that helps. If you got specific questions about that, give me a call and we'll figure it out. And it would be fun if you thought you didn't have these soils. We'll figure that out too. Stickers in the yard. You know, I missed my caller about stickers in the yard. We'll come back. There's always a reason why, and I love the fact that we know to call them stickers. You know, it's just funny because it seems like there's a bunch of new names out there because people have forgotten what stickers are. But stickers are those things that get in your feet, and stickers occur because you're scalping your yard. Or because there's no grass growing there. And the reason there's no grass growing there ain't because there's stickers there. The stickers are there because there ain't no grass. You see what I'm saying? Different cause and effect. The grass disappeared. Either you're cutting it too short or the soil is compacted or some other reason. Be careful to raise your mower height. If you raise your mower height and your grass is healthy, you won't have stickers. It's that simple. It is that simple. So call me if you think I'm wrong. You call me and let's talk about it and let's figure it out. But stickers need lots of bare ground. They need the ground to see the sunlight. They need the bare dirt to see the sunlight, and they don't like competition. They hate competition from grass. So if you scalp your yard, I used to have stickers in my yard when I was growing up. And you know why I had stickers in the yard when I was growing up? Because I was mowing the yard. It's that simple. Because I didn't want to mow the yard. And so I turned the mower down to the lowest setting I possibly could, thinking it would slow the grass down. And not only did it slow the grass down, it killed the grass. And you know what happened? I got stickers. And every time we played football in the front yard barefoot, I got stickers in my feet. And I thought, gosh, what a terrible thing. Who did this to me? I did it to me. How's that? Stickers is our fault. That's what I like to think. Got a caller. Jim, I'm listening. What's going on?
Hey, good morning, Bill. How are you today?
Good.
I was just wondering, my lemon tree has not put on any flowers this year, and I was wondering if that's, I'm sure it's because of the cold, but, you know, am I not going to get any lemons this year?
Jim, turn down your radio for just a second.
My radio's not on.
Okay, got a little feedback.
Okay, I took it off a speakerphone.
Ah, that's it. Sorry. I knew there's something weird going on. Hey, so will you get any lemons this year? Well, that's a good question. There's a chance you will. Lemons, and what kind of lemon tree do you have? Do you know?
It's an Improved Meyer lemon.
Improved Meyer, yeah. Well, they're less prone to it, but most lemons will produce more than one crop of flowers per year. And the, okay. The chances are good that you'll get more flowering. Here's the problem, however. If that flowering doesn't occur until, say, June or July.
Yeah, that's a little late.
It's late.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might be able to harvest the fruit. You might be able to harvest the fruit in fall or winter. I assume this tree's outside, right?
Yes,
not
it is,
in a
yeah.
pot, right? Yep. So, yeah, it's possible. It's possible. Okay. But I think mostly you're going to want to wait until next year and not get too excited. Yeah.
Figured, but I wasn't sure. I got like 3 flowers on it this year, but last year I had like 140 lemons on this one little tree. So.
Yeah, and now let me go back and say the stress of producing all those extra lemons means that it probably needs the break anyway.
Yeah,
so,
maybe.
Yeah, so it'll be fine. It'll be good. And, you know, next time we get these really cold temperatures, and it's hard to say exactly what temperature it is, but when it gets below about 25 degrees, if you want to ensure that you get fruit, come up with some way to cover the tree with a frost cloth or with a canvas cloth or something that helps to protect it from that extra cold.
Yeah,
and you just have to do it for that night.
It's usually raining when it gets cold like that, and then it blew off and all that type of good stuff. But I
that's right.
The bottom alive because I put a spot
at
the bottom when it gets cold, so right by the root area. So.
Yeah, and you know that's right. So it's. Myers, there's a certain degree at which, I mean, when it gets down to around 15 degrees and 16 degrees, it's really tough.
Yeah.
There's no question. But normally it's between 20 and 25, and at those temperatures we can usually protect the fruit mm-hmm. just by putting a frost cloth over it.
Okay.
And so be thinking about that next year for how you might do that. So you can gather that ground heat and keep your flowers on.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. You have a great day.
All right, Jim. Good to hear from you. Hey, I would say to Jim too, and Lisbon lemons. Meyer's lemon is not a true lemon. It's more like an orange, and it's not as what's the word remontant. It doesn't produce flowers. Successionally quite as well as Lisbon lemon, but it'll produce a second crop of lemon sometimes. But Lisbon lemons, they'll produce flowers all year long. Nice reason to have them in a pot, by the way. Gosh, sounds like we gotta take a break here and come right back. We will.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and be one, go home. 6 foot, 7 foot.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that is where all become tiptoe, through the tulips, with me.
geez, you know, we want to be nice. But there it is. Lots of good questions that I'm going to try to get to this morning. Beautiful, you know, Clay up in Birmingham, he's got it figured out. So he's got some beautiful radishes coming through. I've been, you know, I picked a lot of radishes this spring. They're really nice to have. Radishes, one of the great unheralded garden products of for southern gardens, and they're in the shoulder seasons. I mean, you want to do them. You don't do them as much during summer, but boy, during spring, there's a whole series of them that are about 20 and 30 day radishes. That looks like what Clay did, and then in fall, in fall meaning you can start planting them in August. On the Gulf Coast, you can plant probably even earlier. In North Alabama, I hadn't fully experimented how early. But the fact of the matter is you can plant them in August and on the Gulf Coast for sure, and you get these incredible, big, huge radishes all winter long. The long fall radishes, really beautiful thing, wonderful thing. Now Clay's getting ready to plant them with rattlesnake beans. A couple of questions about pruning. Well, several questions about pruning. I don't think I'm going to get to all of them this hour, but I'm going to try to come back. First off, somebody sent me a picture of a satsuma tree and said, can I prune this tree now? And I want to say no, because here's the simple thing. That tree don't need pruning. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. She said, well, the limbs are touching the ground. Exactly. You want that to happen. That is the coolest, neatest, most wonderful thing about a satsuma, is the fact that it weeps. And it should weep. And that makes it really easy to pick. And you don't need to mow under it. What are you going to mow under it for? It's not anything growing there. And that's the other good thing about the limbs growing to the ground, is it basically gets rid of all the weeds. You can go in and you can pull out the vines if you like. But don't prune that satsuma. Satsumas do not benefit from pruning. It's just that simple. Plant your satsuma so that it's not too close to the house so that you don't have to prune it. Because if you do, you're going to make a mess of it. But satsumas, it's just the simplest thing for me to say, don't prune it, ever. If there's a broken limb, I'll prune my satsumas. But other than that, I wouldn't, there's just, don't prune them. That's that simple. You want them to weep. You want that foliage to be near the ground. Is that okay? Think of it as a large hoop-skirted azalea. Well, never mind, because you brutalize your azaleas too. Well, don't. Just think of it as a big hoop skirt. How's that? Dan, you know, nasturtiums, I love nasturtiums. Are they not? I am such a sucker for them. I don't know why I can't. I can't tell you. Well, I know why. Because they're beautiful. The flower colors are beautiful. There's a bunch of different beautiful flower colors. The leaves are great. And you know what? They're delicious. They're absolutely delicious. You can use them in salads. You can use the flowers in salads. What a versatile crop. Another shoulder season crop for us. It's not, they don't do well in hot summer, in high summer, but they do well into American summer, which we're in the midst of now. And they can do pretty well for a while in American summer. They'll do great again in fall. They can do well throughout the entire winter, except you just bring them, put them in pots, bring them inside on the coldest nights. Really good. So that one is, Dan is getting his Tithonias ready. Yeah. Never start the Tithonias too early. But yeah, time is right. The time is now. I would say late April, early May, best time to start Tithonia along the Gulf Coast. A little later, maybe just a little later towards the end of middle of May, farther north. So a lot of pictures coming up for me of camphor trees. You know, I can't tell you how many camphor tree pictures I've got. Says something about how weedy they've become. They're a North Vietnamese South China tree that we planted here many, many years ago, and they cause a lot of problems. They can be a little obnoxious. That smell is the smell of camphor. And you never can doubt, because if you crush it and it's got that, it just smells overwhelmingly like camphor. You know what Campo Phoenix smells like? What does camphor smell like? Eucalyptus kind of a smell, but more like camphor. There it is. Camphor tree. It is the camphor tree that is invading so many places. Let's see, a couple of more pruning questions. Is it a good time to prune? Rusty said, is it a good time to prune the fig? You know, Rusty, that's a good question. I think if you're going to prune out some branches that you wouldn't be able to reach and only the mockingbirds can reach, you might as well. You see what I'm saying? Because that really is the measure of why a fig tree should be pruned, is so that the figs come to your hand and not the mockingbird's hands. You don't have to prune every tree. Not every fruiting tree needs to be pruned. Satsumas don't need to, but it helps to prune figs for a lot of reasons. Because of the way they fruit, and because of the fact that you're having to compete with birds, and because you don't want to have to get a ladder out. So there it is. Otherwise, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Right now, and just let it go, and then come back. Brian's going to call back after the break. That's good, Brian. We wouldn't have time to get into that this side of the break, but we're going to call back and think about that. Let me think what else we got. Thomas, on your holly. Thomas sent me a picture of holly last week, and the suckers, he's trying to get it to be a tree form, and I see why. It's a good specimen. I think, Thomas, you need a saw. And let's take a saw, and let's trim those back. Let me tell you, with the saw, or you need some better pruners. But with a saw, very sharp blades, you might have to use the pruners just a little bit, because it's a mess in there, isn't it? You want to prune it back so that those little branches that are coming back lower on the trunk, you want to prune them back as flush as possible, but you don't want to prune back to the trunk. So you want to leave a little collar, just a little bit of a collar, a little tiny bit of a collar on each prune. But it looks to me like... looks to me like you hadn't been pruning them quite as close as you might like. You don't want to prune them right into the trunk. But leave a little collar. Use a saw. Looks like you need to use a saw rather than just pruners. Get a good sharp saw to do this. And sometimes you might need to come in from the bottom side. And a mechanical saw is not going to help you. You need a fine-toothed saw, hand saw, one-handed hand saw, fine-toothed. And I think that's going to be a lot better. Some of them you can still get. And it's going to take a little bit of work. I mean, every year you're going to have to do a little bit. But I think a saw will help you. Well, we got a lot of questions to ask, to answer. You got a lot of questions to ask. We're going to be back. We got some pretty fun stuff coming up. Not to mention Buck Allen with his baby donkey. We'll be back.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. Listen, we got lots of things to do. I got lots of questions to answer, lots of fun things to talk about. Let's see. I know we've got some callers. I don't know even. I'm telling you, I don't know where to start. Because we got a lot of fun things to do. First off, I want to talk about this, though. So, Buck Allen, when you say you're gonna have a picture contest, you anticipate certain things happening in the picture contest. I mean, you hope some things don't happen, honestly. Hoping that, but there's some things you just don't imagine happening. And so we got this picture contest, right? People send in their pictures to Facebook. And they post them on Facebook on FM Talk 106.5. And then Sean's got this thing a little set up so that everybody gets to vote. And if the picture that gets voted best gets a poster. And it's a cool poster. It's on hard paper. And it's got the Wonder Wheel, which gives you a good guide to when to plant along the Gulf Coast. Really cool thing. But you're imagining what kind of pictures come in, but you would not imagine, you could name a lot of pictures that you anticipate coming in to something like this, but you wouldn't imagine a donkey sitting in a man's lap. Would you, Buck? Buck must have known that. So Buck has a donkey sitting in his lap, and it's a rather pleasant, cozy scene. I know you have a hard time imagining that a donkey sitting in a man's lap is something pleasant and cozy. But it is cozy. It just looks cozy, and you just got to see it. It's a foal. Right? As he can be. So, just by the way, really cool thing. Let's see what we got here. Have we got some, let's see if we don't have some callers. Have we got a caller? Yeah, I'm listening. Dean, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Bill. Sir, I got this couple-year-old plum tree, and you always said there's something else that when they mate the plum tree as it was young, that's, you know, it's growing off to the side of it. You know, it's not actually looking like the plum tree. Go ahead.
Dean.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I can help you here.
Yep.
A little bit, at least. So it means that they are welded onto, is the best way to describe it, a different kind of rootstock sometimes. And the desirable plum on top has been welded onto a rootstock that it makes it a little easier for that plum to live and to produce and to be propagated. And that's it. Now, what I'm seeing is that the growth coming from the bottom is from the rootstock, the very lowest growth that's coming out of, we seem to be having some difficulties. Okay. There we go. So the growth that's coming right from the bottom is in fact not desirable. It's not the desired growth that you want. And so it needs to be pruned off. And it's the longer leaves. I mean, I think you've already guessed it. The one with the longer leaves and coming right out of the soil. Dina, I'll tell you something else about the picture that I saw, and that is you planted the plum a little bit too deep so that the graft is below the surface of the ground. And that's going to cause problems. You may see more problems. It may be harder to manage that plum. I'm amazed that it's doing as well as it's doing, but it will make it a little bit harder. So next time when you plant, make sure that the roots, you actually want to see the roots emerging from the trunk above the ground just a little bit. You want to see that flare where the roots come out of the trunk. So there you go. Dean, you hearing me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. And did that help?
Yes, sir, it did. I thank you very much.
All right, Dean. Just go ahead and prune off those ones with the long leaves and see what happens. Hey, Dean.
Yes.
You still there?
Yes.
If you get any plums off that tree, I want you to tell me. Have you ever had plums off of it? Wow, that's good.
Yes, sir, but
that's really good.
I didn't eat them. You always said wait about 3 years.
I see. Well, that's right. So
concerned about that extra growth.
Yep. Good. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Bill.
Thanks, D. Yes, sir. Okay. There's little hiccups here. I'm hearing. Sorry about that. Fish Sniper sent me a picture. We're going to try to fix that here soon. Fish Sniper sent me a picture of a tree that they got from the Arbor Day folks. The Arbor Day folks are kind of annoying, I'll just tell you. Because they kind of annoy me. Because they are looking for your money. And I don't know what they do with your money. I'm never quite sure. But they send you trees that don't necessarily do well on the Gulf Coast. They try to send, they're the ultimate Walmart. They're the ultimate Walmart. They're going to try to reduce plants to 12 plants that grow everywhere in the U.S. And that just doesn't work. It's terrible. But what they sent you was, in this case, a redbud. And it is alive. That's good. It won't be alive for that long, but it'll live for a little while. Redbuds, Arbor Day, folks. But that's a redbud. That is a redbud. You can tell by the heart-shaped leaves. Very good. On the other hand, Fish Sniper, those creeping jennies just look great. They like where they are. I don't know if that redbud's going to like where it is, but those creeping jennies, they like where they are. They like where they are. Let's see what else we got here. If I gotten everybody else's questions, we did talk a little bit about hibiscus, and we got some questions about the edible hibiscus. And let me go over that one more time. I'm going to say that there are four types of edible hibiscus, and I'm going to start off with the first one, which is going to surprise you. Okra. Okra is not a true hibiscus, but it is very closely related. And you can see it in the flowers. The neat thing about okra, and I think the thing that people don't realize about okra, is that the whole okra plant can be eaten. You can eat the pods. You can eat the flowers. The flowers are actually quite good. I love okra flowers in salads. They're really delicious. They kind of have that okra flavor, but they're really delicious, believe it or not. Okra flowers are really good. The leaves on okra can be eaten as well. And that's a prelude, and a lot of people really like the leaves. They're kind of a feature in a lot of cultural cuisines, the leaves of okra. Wow. Now, I don't know whether you want to, if you don't want to strip your okra too bad, because you might not get as many pods. Just to let you know, and that's a good way of understanding that a lot of hibiscus are edible. Not all, but a lot are edible. And it can be the flowers or the leaves on many plants. There's a very, very close relative of okra that is usually sold as Abel moschus or, I don't know, muskmallow or various things. It's hard to get it, but if you can find it, there's some great varieties out there. They are grown for their leaves. The leaves are deliciously edible. They're quite good. They're like a salad green, just really, really delicious. And then there's the true hibiscus, and I guess we're going to have to come back after this break and talk about them.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Plain Gardening.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming.
There. That's going to be... You're going to hear me a little better now. I can tell. Listen, we got a lot of things to talk about this morning. A lot of questions to answer. I'm going to try to hit them as quickly as I can. Pruning tools. Brian wants to talk about some tools as well and some prescribed burns. Brian, you can give us a call here in that next segment and let's talk about it. But if I had to choose some pruning tools, let's start here. You want the Felco hand pruners. They make a big difference. F-E-L-C-O. It's always wise to invest in them. They work. A lot of hand pruners don't work. And this is a single-handed hand pruner. You really do need them. They work in many, many cases to do the kinds of things you need to do. If I were going to get a long-handled hand pruner, the one that's about, 2.5 feet long, 30 inches long, with a little nose, a little clippers at the nose. We're not talking about head shears. Talking about the little clippers at the nose. I have never been happy with anvils, pruners. They don't, in general to me, they don't make a good clean cut. They don't allow you to be as precise about your cut. And they just don't work as well. I don't rule out that there's a good one out there, but I would recommend the Corona bypass pruners, long handle pruners. Corona makes a good one. I'm pretty sure it's Corona that I've got. I'll double check, but I think it is Corona. I don't like Corona's single handed pruners, but their long handle pruners are very good, very effective, and they're the right price. I mean, they're not too expensive, they're not too cheap, they're good. Silky makes the best pruning saws. Incredible pruning saws. Incredibly expensive. But they're good. And I will tell you, they make your life so much easier that it is wise sometimes to get some Silky saws and get a cheaper saw for things that you don't need or they're really fine tooth Silkies for. If you're going to get a pruning saw for pruning high into a tree, a pole saw, Silkies are the ones. I don't beat me up about the price because they ain't cheap, but boy, are they good. Boy, are they efficient. It makes a whole lot more sense to spend money on a good Silky saw than on motorized things. And you can think of that comparison. They'll last longer. You'll actually spend less money on a Silky in the long run. So there it is. My thoughts on that. So Barry has sent me a picture of a citrus, and it's got speckles on the top, and if I look carefully, at some of those pictures, and he didn't send me a picture of the underside of the leaves, but it looks like he's got citrus rust mite. And the citrus rust mite probably occurred last year. It probably happened last year, is my guess. And those leaves are just hanging on, and they're looking worse and worse as the season goes on. I don't think it's happening this year, but it could be. The new leaves look fine. I think it's citrus rust mite damage from last year. And this is on a Myers lemon. Did you notice, Barry, that on your Myers lemons last year, did you notice that some of the fruits had kind of a rusty look on them? If you did, I think it probably was citrus rust mite, and I think that's why these leaves are just kind of, they're tired, they're beat up. They're getting ready to fall off. They probably will. The new leaves are coming on pretty good. They probably need some fertilizer. The tree probably needs some fertilizer right about now. It's getting ready to flower as well. All these things are happening at once. Make sure it's fertilized well. If you haven't changed the soil in a while, you need to change the soil in that pot. So we got a lot of things to talk about. And I think that the citrus rust mite is probably done. I think the citrus rust mite is the thing I'm going to worry about the least. We want to make sure we get a lot of new leaves coming on that plant and the flowers, and we want to make sure it has the strength. So if you want to call me about the details on that, we can. You certainly can, and we certainly can talk about it. John is asking me about a variety of peach that does good on the Gulf Coast. And John, there's a very simple answer for that. None. There are no varieties of peach that aren't just a total pain in the patootie. Peaches are from, you know, they're basically from Afghanistan. I mean, they're from a dry climate. They're from over in that part of the world somewhere. Persia, Iran, that is the home of the peach. And it's a dry climate. And peaches don't do well when they are introduced to wet climates like ours. Georgia, yeah. Any rate, it's hard to find a peach that's going to be easy. There are peaches that I think have a good balance of flavor and disease resistance. But you're going to have to look at some of the varieties out of Florida that don't have a lot of chill requirements. La Feliciana was kind of the standard by which other Gulf Coast peaches were judged. You're probably going to get enough chill hours that you can grow La Feliciana. It's one that I would certainly try. Sewanee I've tried, and it probably, some years you're going to get a good crop and some years not. But they were two old-fashioned varieties that have a good flavor and decent disease and pest resistance. But you're always going to have pest problems with peaches. Borers are a huge issue. There's lots of diseases that affect leaves. If you expect perfect fruit, you're probably not going to get it. It is interesting. It would be nice to go back to some of the original varieties of peaches that used to be part of the peach plantations along the Gulf Coast that were Creeks and Choctaws planted, because they didn't have sprays and other things. But I'll tell you, those peaches don't look like modern peaches. They were harder. They were probably good pickled. And it's probably worth thinking about some of those. But, oh boy, I'm beating around the bush and saying, what's the best peach for the Gulf Coast? A persimmon. There it is. The best peach for the Gulf Coast is a persimmon. It is so much better in every way. So just think about that. I'm just going to say. Barry, let's talk about that lemon tree for just a second. You there?
All right. I'm here.
Yeah. So
I'm here.
So let me ask you, did you notice any russeting on your fruit last year? Did you notice your fruit kind of had some bronze?
No.
Fruit was fine.
The few lemons, the few Meyer lemons that came off were beautiful. They were clean. And they were beautiful, and they taste good. And they after that, when the weather broke, in fact, I didn't even cover the tree up. It's up on a deck right outside of a window on the east side of the house, facing the river, facing the creek. I have a kind of little microclimate down here. They were not hurt by any of the real bad cold weather. All the leaves have that speckly stuff. I say speckly stuff. To me, it seems to be in the leaf. I thought it was maybe missing a nutrient or something.
No, not really. But yes, that's a problem. But that's not what is causing the speckling. The speckling is a result of a mite, almost certainly. And I can't see the leaves well enough to be absolutely sure, but I'm pretty sure it's a mite. I don't know that the mite is still active. Probably the winter wiped out the mite, and it's probably not what you're seeing is damage from last year. If you left it outside during the winter, I think the mites are probably not a problem now. What worries me is the only thing I would say is that you do want to worry about nutrition, and you want to worry about that soil getting compacted. When was the last time you changed the soil out?
I planted it in that pot year before last, so yes, it needs some shaking up a little bit. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so I would say it looks like the soil is getting a little bit compacted. It looks like you've lost a bit of soil depth, and that's going to inhibit the growth of the plant. If you can, it's getting to a stage, if you can plant it in a slightly larger pot, it's probably okay to do it now. It's a little bit stressful now that it's putting on leaves, or you can wait until it puts on its new leaves and then replant. But I think it could use some more soil, and of course it needs fertilizer, but any Miracle-Gro will work just fine. There's no special fertilizer, and Miracle-Gro, if you can remember to apply it regularly as a liquid fertilizer, or Peters or any of them, they are now formulated the way they should, so that they have very low phosphorus. And that's good. You can use those on your citrus.
What if I took a garden fork and kind of loosened everything up? It's got mulch around the top of the pot right now. What if I took that mulch out and took a garden fork and loosened everything up and put some new soil and then some new mulch on top of that?
Just a thought. Won't help at all. It won't help at all.
It won't? Okay.
It will be zero benefit. What you really want is the soil down in the bottom of the pot is going to be most compacted. And it's kind of a bottom-up problem. What I would do is when you pull it out of the pot, what you can do is you can shake the loose soil off. You'll find that the roots are wrapping around that container. They'll be running in circles. And if you've got an old hickory knife, you remember when people used to have old hickories for kitchen knives? Have you ever seen those?
Yeah.
Just find an old kitchen knife that's about, that's got a blade on it about, how long is that? I'm looking at my hands. That must be 14 inches, 12 inches.
Slicing knife or a long serrated bread knife.
That'd be fine. And just slice down along the edges to slice those roots. And then put it back in new potting soil. Shake it again and then put it in the new potting soil.
Okay.
Cut off the bottom. Take about a quarter of the plant off the bottom. Just cut the roots off the bottom, just a quarter of them. Just slice it off and then put them in the new soil.
All right. Will that affect all of this beautiful blooming and
it could. So let's wait. Let's wait till after it blooms. Well, yeah, and we got to take a break, but let's wait till after it blooms to do that. All right.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days.
Hey, we're back. I said peaches are hard. Peaches are hard. All my friends I go to my friends at Auburn and I say peaches are hard, and they shake their heads and they say peaches are hard. It can take a lot of spraying and a lot of work to get peaches for the Gulf Coast. There's no easy variety. I love La Feliciana. It's delicious. Sewanee is a good one. There's some good ones coming out of Florida. I don't keep up with all of them because they're all hard in the end. However, naturally enough, someone sends me a picture. Who is this? Beverly? Showing a beautiful peaches that she picked out of her yard. And Beverly, you'll have to call us sometime and talk to me about what you did to get those peaches. There's generally a chemical spray regime that has to go along with peaches. I suppose if you get lucky, you could avoid it some years, but mostly you got to get really lucky. So there it is. Brian, so we've been off and on. You still there, Brian? You still got time?
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Good. So, good. I'm just not going to hide it, Brian. Brian snuck in and kind of hit me with some questions yesterday, and it was okay because they were good questions, and I take questions about prescribed burning when I don't take other questions, because fire is really important to the world in a lot of ways, and it's particularly important to our world in Mobile County and in Alabama. Brian, why don't you tell folks what you're up to?
So we've got some acreage down in South Mobile County that's mostly used for hunting, but it's on some pine, some wet pine land that's got some boggy areas, got some pretty neat native pitcher plants down there. It's that area of the farm hasn't really seen fire in a few years. Seemed to prioritize some of the other areas. More so for one reason or another, but we just haven't gotten around to that area. So
uh-oh, Brian, we lost you somehow. Brian. Oh, Brian, too bad. Well, it's interesting. So Brian and I have been talking, and we'll talk more about it in future weeks, about when's the best time to burn. Pitcher plant bogs are wet. Do they really burn? Yeah. and there's a lot of reasons that you have to survive. A pitcher plant bog has to burn occasionally. And probably pretty frequently, honestly. It's the fire return interval for a lot of places on the Gulf Coast naturally, before humans got involved. We're going to put it at about once every 2 to 3 years. And that, we also got to deal with mastodons and mammoths and other things, and that makes it a little more complicated because humans did kind of screw that up too. But we can say naturally that pitcher plant bogs would burn about once every 3 years, or 2 to 3 years, and or about three times every decade. If you go much longer than 3 years, you lose the pitcher plant bog. And they do burn, they're appropriate times. This is the right time of year. May is the perfect time, really, to do a lot of burning. It's probably the most, it's the time when burns happen most often. And Brian and I were talking, because his his father-in-law, I've talked a little bit before too, and I understand there's some good stories his father-in-law shares about our show, which is nice to hear. But you don't have to wait a long time after the rain, because when humidity is low, when there's lots of drying winds, and when the fuel conditions are right, it's going to burn. Even the day after a rain sometimes, 2 days after a rain. And that explains why lightning can be very effective, is that it's not usually a long time after a rain that these conditions are right for the fuel to burn. So this is the right time of year. You want to be careful about it. You want to do it right. We were talking about, Brian and I were talking about tools, because you want to make a good border around these. And maybe we just need to do a whole show on burning and talking about that. Sean won't let me do it on the game show because he's afraid I'm going to corrupt all the hunters. He's afraid I'm going to corrupt them all. That I might teach him something. Just kidding, Sean. But any rate, we should talk more about fire and how to do it. Please be careful with fire. It is very potent. It's very useful. It is very potent. And Brian's having to think about how to trim around it. It's a big question. Brian, are you back now?
Hey, I'm back, Bill. I'm back.
Yeah. Boy, it sounded like you got abducted by aliens or something.
I may have. Got a three-year-old running around with getting the best of me sometimes. So
the three-year-old always gets the blame. Yeah, but that's good. Yeah.
I'm not sure where I left off, but I wanted to mention that I had come across an article that talked about somebody in Mississippi had developed a flamethrower to kind of help out in the pitcher plant bogs when a full prescribed burn wasn't available. Have you read or heard any of that? I've seen that they sell these flamethrowers and, you know, market them to keep weeds away in backyards now at Lowe's and Home Depot.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I certainly have used a propane propane fuel torch to I've used it to ignite fields. It's rather cumbersome and it's not going to really help you manage the whole bog. You're still going to have, once the fire gets started, you got to manage it. I don't think it's a, for your situation, I don't think it's a practical way of, I mean, you're still going to start a fire one way or another, and you're not going to be able to control the fire except with what you're doing along the edges. A propane torch is useful. It can be useful at times. And with small little areas, it can be, and by small areas, I mean areas like 10 by 10. It can be useful in those areas, maybe 20 by 20. In a big bog, I don't think it's useful. I mean, basically, you're starting a fire one way or another, and there's easier ways to start fires. So, like a drip.
Bill, torch. I kind of got the idea that they were cutting these woody shrubs that were coming in and shading out the pitcher plants, and then they would use the flamethrower to scorch those shrubs to try to make it a little bit tougher for them to come back. So it was more of a precise burn than
precise, like instead of Roundup. Yeah, well, that's interesting. It sounds like a lot. It could work. It could work if you can carry that. If you can carry the propane around, it could help. Might help a little bit. There are some other benefits of fire that you probably won't get. It sounds pretty labor intensive, but we should talk more about this, Brian. I hope we will sometime. Let's circle back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. We got lots of things to do in a very short segment, and I'm not going to get to everybody. My auditioning for press secretary. Funny, Rusty. That's just funny. So, I'm not. But listen. There's a bunch of folks who got some questions that we're not going to be able to get to this morning, but the peach thing is just something we shouldn't let go. Ted, I want to talk about dogwoods. I want to talk about those. I want to talk about those blueberries, but I don't want to let the peach thing go. And so, you know, it's hard it's hard sometimes to get peaches to grow here. And I got a message from one of our gems out there saying, you know, I did peaches for a lot of years, and I had great results with a really rigid spray regime. And by rigid spray regime, Jim, that probably means Jim was out there spraying every week or 2 weeks, depending on the rain, just the whole season. And it can be a real pain in the patootie to do that. And you're using lots of really, really not so good chemicals that can be dangerous to you. And that's how we grow peaches now. That's why you get to eat peaches, is because you don't mind eating all those chemicals. You enjoy those chemicals, right? But we got a picture from Beverly of just beautiful peaches. And Beverly, I'm always holding out that there's a way to do this without using a lot of chemicals. How did you do it?
I have never sprayed them. That tree is 15 years old. I've got about 250 peaches on it. Hurricane Sally split the trunk, and we cut the part off that was laying on the ground. And I have another peach tree that I just planted a year ago. It's probably 5 feet tall, just a little skinny stem, and I had four beautiful red peaches on it. And I never sprayed.
Do you know what kind of peach tree do you have? Do you know?
I have the big one? Clue. And it survived my dad running over it in a golf cart.
Yeah, so maybe that all helped, didn't it? And sometimes it's hard, you know. I think sometimes the peaches that do really well, I'm often suspicious that it's the rootstock that the peaches are actually doing well. But you've got yours are pretty nice soft peaches, and they don't look like you've had any kind of you don't see any oozing gummy stuff on the trunk, and you don't see any oozing gummy.
I have seen that in one particular spot, yes. But this tree continues, and I would say probably in the last 5 years, I've gotten this number of peaches every year off that tree. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. And it's, you know, healthy foliage. Now, this year, the hurricane hit it, and like I said, it split, and we had to cut one side off. But I did not trim it because of that. So it was tall, and had a branch broke off because the peaches were so heavy on the branch. And I've got some other branches braced for right now. Now I've got to go ahead and I'm going to have to pick them, and I'm going to have to give them all away because I can't process them all.
Wow. So is the stone free, or does the stone?
And they are so juicy. I don't know if you saw the picture of my grandson. He eats them off the tree, and he is just soaked. They're so juicy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So we'll have to figure out which one that one is. It could be one of the old varieties, like La Feliciana. What's the new red one you? And the new red one you planted, what kind is it?
I don't know. I didn't keep the label. I plant so much.
So you're just
hard to keep track.
You're just tantalizing us, Beverly. You're just tantalizing us.
I have had such success with these peach trees. It's just been, well, this one. And so because when the hurricane split it, I went ahead and bought another to put on the other side of an area that I've got an allee going to my studio. And anyway, so when we got four big, huge red peaches off of that one this morning, I couldn't believe it either because it's so tiny. But yeah, I've had real success with these two peach trees. So anyway, when you said you can't grow peaches here, I thought that's so funny because I haven't sprayed or anything, and it just produces.
Well, and as sure as I tell people that they can grow peaches, and I've tried, and I've gotten a few peaches, I will, as sure as I do, they will call back and say, God, I had terrible luck with peaches. I got bugs all over them. And there are these exceptions that I can't explain, and I want to explain them, but I have a hard time.
Well, now, I bought my two peach trees from Racine's, which is a feed store over in Robertsdale, And she gets a lot of her stuff from Louisiana. So it may be a variety from, you know, the one you're talking about.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's, and that's good. That's
producing and producing.
Well, that's very good. So that's good. So we'll have to think about peaches some more. And Beverly, if anything happens to those peaches, you got to report to us so we know. Okay.
Oh, I will.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. Thank you. We've got a little bit of time. Jarhead, I hadn't heard from you in a while. You still there?
Oh yeah, I'm still here. But I know your time is short, so I just have a question about a herbicide, and I want to know if you've ever heard of it. It's called Mojave.
I don't know it. Do you know what's in it? Do you know what the active ingredients are?
I don't know, but this stuff's supposed to make Roundup look like Kool-Aid. It's bought a bag of $65 for about, maybe a pound, 2 pound bag, and like a third of a cup to a gallon of water or a big gallon sprayer or something like that is supposed to kill not only the weeds, but anything you put it on.
Huh. Well, yes, it may. And who knows? And the manufacturer, you want to know whether it's ground active. And this is pretty important. If it's ground active, that means that you're not going to be able to grow anything else there for a while. So be careful about that. The nice thing about Roundup is that it isn't ground active. It's one of the reasons I trust it really well, because I know that once it hits the ground, it's just going to basically break down and dissipate, and I don't have to worry about any residual effect, which you don't want, or you'll lose everything. That's one thing, and you need to know whether it affects some plants more than others. I'll look it up. I don't know it. I'll have to say.
I have the box here, Bill. Is Emma Pry or something like that, and Duron.
Yeah, Imazapyr and Duron.
Yeah.
Yes. So
that's Alligar.
That's
Alligar. Anyway, I personally bought it for the trash trees that grow on your fence. So I'm not really going to use it around anything that I don't want to kill. I was just curious to see if you ever heard of it.
No, but I have heard of Imazapyr. I'll look that up and talk about it a little bit more next week. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about herbicides next week. It's a good time to do it. Thanks. We gotta go, folks. We'll be back next week.